Hello, Internet. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which is live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. We're broadcasting at davidrovics.com/quarantine on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, as well as via my channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. You can find all these discussions archived on my YouTube channel in the Discussions with David playlist and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform or go to davidrovics.com. Today's guest is one of a small group of people who I have seen fairly regularly over the years, despite the fact that we rarely see each other in the same place twice. When I first met Jack, he lived in Hong Kong. As we speak today, I believe he's in Ecuador. He was born Scottish and grew up on that island known to some as Great Britain. A very large part of his adult life has been spent traveling the world while working as an international recruiter for various colleges and universities. Jack has written under various pseudonyms for Socialist Action and other publications over the years. He has written 100 essays about the 100 countries he has traveled in, and they all contain wonderful insights into the societies he spent time in, sometimes a lot of time. I'm one of the few people who has had the opportunity to read any of those essays, since, as far as I know, they remain unpublished. Jack, welcome to my little live stream show.
Buenos dias.
Have you? Buenos dias. You're currently in Ecuador still, I believe, and I wonder if we could just start out with telling us about what's your impressions of the situation there. I know it's been one of the hotspots for the virus in South America.
Yeah, I'm in Quito, Ecuador. It's the capital. It's not the worst hit city. The worst hit city is Guayaquil, which I hadn't even heard of before I moved here. But it's the biggest city in Ecuador. It's on the coast. There's about 3 million people there, and they've been hit very hard. That's where 90% of the cases are in Ecuador. And Ecuador is one of the worst hit city countries in Latin America. From what I've heard from reliable sources, the death toll and the infection rate is much higher than the official figures because we don't have as much testing capabilities. For example, they look at statistics from how many people died during the first 4 months of last year compared to this year. And it's they reckon the death toll is maybe 10 times as high as the official figures. So Guayaquil has been hit very hard. And they think it's for a number of reasons. That's where the infections first started. It came from a family coming back from Spain, because there's hundreds of thousands of Ecuadorian immigrants in Spain. And it spread very quickly there. It's the first port of entry. Also, anecdotally, Guayaquileños, they're on the coast. They tend to take life less seriously. They're out and about. They don't listen to stay-at-home warnings. They were just kind of treating it as a holiday. So it kind of spread a lot quicker there. Quito, it's not been as badly hit. People seem to be respecting the stay-at-home guidelines from the government. We have a 2 p.m. curfew, so we're only allowed out from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., and people respect that. If you need to leave in your car, you need to have salve conducto, safe passage pass. Like if you have to deliver food or you work in the medical industry. They also have something called pica y placa here, which means it's to do with the first number on your number plate, your registration plate on your car. So if you're 1 and 2, you can go out on Monday, 3 and 4 on Tuesday, etc. So there's not much traffic, but people here seem to be respecting it, and we don't have too many cases in Quito. The rest of the country is different. It's very provincial, so the provincial governors tend to govern their province and don't always follow the government guidelines.
Mm-hmm. And in Ecuador, there were huge protests going on just prior to the onset of the pandemic, not to mention in many other countries in the world like Chile, but you were there for those protests. And I wonder just what can you set the stage for the coming of the pandemic? What was going on there just before?
I think it was in October or November. It was called El Paro, the strike here. In some ways, it was good. It kind of prepared people because they had a military curfew then as well. for about a week. So when it happened again now, people are like, oh, it's another one. We've done this before. So we kind of had some practice with staying at home, being sensible with food and going to the supermarket. The background on the strike, it was the IMF has come back into Ecuador and they imposed rules. They said, okay, you can have money, but you're going to do this, 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 and this. And one of them was to abolish the fuel subsidy. And a lot of indigenous people, I think it's about 20-25% indigenous in Ecuador. and they're the guys who grow all the food and deliver it to markets for us to eat. Mm. And they rely heavily on fuel subsidies. And obviously a lot of the middle classes, the people in the cities, had the attitude of, well, if you can afford to own a car, you can afford to pay extra for petrol, don't use your car as much. But it's not for people using their cars that's the problem. It's for workers who need it for their tractors, for their trucks to deliver food. So, and it's happened before. They brought down governments before. The indigenous people came in there, tens, hundreds of thousands, to Quito and just blocked it for 2 or 3 weeks. Wow. And it was really cool to see. They're very organized. I mean, they've been organizing themselves for hundreds of years.
It seems like an amazing example of a protest, of a movement that just got what it was demanding, and doing it by what so many radicals around the world are always saying to people who say, oh, we have to have a petition, or we have to have a nice little protest and then go home afterwards or whatever. And then, you know, some of us are always saying, no, we have to shut down business as usual and stop everything from running, you know, like, and that's what they're doing there when they come out of the woods. Yeah,
and it was interesting to see, because I remember that when we had the presidential election 2 years ago, and the guy who at the time was kind of on the left, he's not that left, but he was left of the other guy. Mm. And obviously all the middle class, the elites, wanted the other guy to win. And the other guy, Lasso, he owned all the polling companies. So he was issuing, saying, look, I'm ahead in the polls, I'm going to win. And he didn't win. And then the kind of upper middle class came out to protest. And they stayed about 3 hours, a couple of hundred of them, and then went home. They have no, as soon as they got a bit peckish, they went home.
Yeah.
Really understand the concept of protesting.
People have often mentioned that the contrast between the crowds, depending on who's protesting in Venezuela, I've heard people often mention, like, if it's a pro-government rally, then it's people of all ages, and if it's a anti-government rally, there's no children, because they're all home with their nannies.
Yeah, that's really true.
You, one of the things, I mean, you've been doing, I don't know, are you still working as a university recruiter? Is that, or was that not the situation now?
I'm still in the same field. I work as a college counselor at the moment. I'm actually in a school and I advise students and help them with their applications to universities around the world. I was a university recruiter for 4 years for a US university. But now I'm on the other side.
One of the things you mentioned at some point that you were doing with this university in Quito, I believe it was helping the university to make more connections with academic departments at universities in Eastern Europe. And that, I think, is a fascinating project. And I didn't also realize, like, how many connections the university in Quito has with universities in the United States. And you mentioned, I don't know, perhaps a little jokingly, but I don't know, maybe not, about your decolonization of the university project. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually wearing a hoodie from, the camera's reversed. Okay. From the University of Szeged in Eastern Hungary. Don't give me a hoodie. One thing I noticed amongst college counselors, there is a lot of educational imperialism. If you look at the main countries where international students tend to go or tend to apply, they're all either the main five colonial powers of Great Britain, France, Spain, Germany, and Holland, or they're the white colonial settlerist countries like the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I found that interesting, and then I started investigating other countries like the Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, and Eastern Europe. The education level is excellent. They have a history of, I mean, for example, one of the ones I work with is Charles University in Prague. It's one of the oldest in the world from, I think, 1267. Einstein was a professor there. And they're also very affordable, and they're great places to live. So when I was looking at students applying to, let me give a generic name, State University of Oakland, Nebraska, or whatever, for $25,000 a year. But then they could go and live in Prague. And on top of that, you have accommodation costs, living costs, which bring it up to $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 a year. And you can get probably a better education living somewhere like Prague or Budapest or Wrocław in Poland for $10,000 a year, and maybe get a part-time job as well. It just made no sense. It's just I think there's just the myth that these education systems, like in the US or the UK, are just better, but it's not true. It's not true.
It's like a myth largely based on just a lot of advertising. It seems like Coke is better than Pepsi or something. Like have you been engaged with that kind of project long enough to know many students in Ecuador who actually have gone to study in Prague or Budapest, and what their experience was like? Or it's a little too early to in the process?
No, not at all. My first year I sent one. Out of 50 students. The next year it was 10, and last year I think it was 15 or more. So I have students in Kaunas, Lithuania, which is where Sugihara from your son had his embassy. Prague, Brno in the Czech Republic, Budapest, Pesh in Hungary, all over.
And everybody's had good experiences studying in all those places? Because, I mean, for our audience, who is largely from Western Europe and North America, there's a lot of propaganda out there, true or false, about how unwelcome foreigners are in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, I can talk about that as well. It's none of the students have come back. They all love it. They all tell their friends, like, you should come and stay here. Some of the students who did initially go to the US are now applying to go to Europe, especially the ones in Florida. It's not what they thought it was. I can totally get it. I mean, if I was an 18-year-old kid and I had the chance to go and study in one of these cities, and it's not just that you're living in Prague or Budapest, you've traveled around Europe, you know how easy it is just to get on a train or a bus and be somewhere completely different in a few hours. So the education outside the classroom is vastly superior with the different cultures they come into contact with, the museums, the culture, the history. And the point about, racism, especially Hungary, we hear a lot about... Orban, he's not a great guy. There's not many countries that have an agreeable president, as you know, or prime minister. But on the ground, culturally, I've spoken to students about this, and occasionally they'll get looks, especially if they're Afro-Caribbean or they obviously look foreign. They'll get maybe looked at because it's rare wherever they are. Maybe a few tuts or people being rude, but there's certainly no chance of being shot by the police in Hungary reaching for your wallet. Or, I mean, that would just be, it wouldn't even enter the equation. It's ridiculous to even think of that. They do have.
Do the average cops in Hungary even carry guns?
I don't know. I think they do. Because,
I mean, in many countries in Europe, the cops on the street don't even have guns. And they only get the guns out when there's a gun crime in process, right, in progress. And then they get the big guns out. They don't mess around at that point.
Yeah, it's not the first resort for someone jaywalking or selling cigarettes, no. I mean, they do carry guns in Hungary or Czech Republic, but no. I don't think I've ever seen a story of a policeman using his gun in Europe. It just doesn't happen. It's completely alien. So the students there are completely safe. One thing, I mean, not many people have heard of Ecuador. Ecuador kind of gets forgotten about in terms of everything. So when my students tell people they're from Ecuador, nobody knows where it is. So then they have to say it's next to Colombia. And then feel like, yeah, Pablo Escobar. And then they all get called Pablo. And it's not any kind of racist thing. It's just people don't have the connection. Like being Latino doesn't exist in Europe.
Well, being Latino, yeah. It's not really a category, right? In European, you're not from one of the more countries that we have a lot of people from. So it's not, yeah.
It's more of a U.S. thing. When they go there, they're just a guy with a Spanish name.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Right.
Interesting. One of the places that if you're hanging out in the sort of left wing circles of the internet, you know, there's a lot of people who have a lot of opinions about a lot of places. But one of those places that probably people have more opinions about that both from, you know, either worshiping or hating or, you know, everything in between, usually extreme opinions, is Belarus. And you've been to Belarus on a number of occasions, I believe, right? And currently it's been in the news because they're not locking down their society. And usually if Belarus gets in the news, it's for, you know, something that the government is doing that the West doesn't like. And of course the good things that happened there are never talked about because it's threatening to capitalism to think that there might be a relatively prosperous society that's not embracing the free market so much. But can you talk a bit about your experiences in Belarus and any reflections you have on what's going on there currently?
Yeah, I like Belarus. I had a good time there. It's, I think a lot of the criticism comes from, maybe the West doesn't understand that they don't want to be like us. They're happy being themselves, being Belarus, maybe being closer to Russia. Obviously, the West would like its markets because they're not what we'd call a free market economy, capitalist economy. But when I went there, I wasn't sure. You watch YouTube videos, travel logs, and it's typically scaremongering, is still run by the KGB, everything's banned. So we went there, and I remember when we first, we were in Minsk, and then we went to Brest, which is on the Polish border. There was a big battle there in the war. And we were just sitting there in the morning having a coffee and just watching the world go by. And me and my friend Alex, we weren't talking, and we were just observing. And then we kind of looked at each other and said, is this real? It was like the Truman Show. It just seemed too perfect. Like families out pushing their kids, people playing in the street. It was just really nice. I know. And now if you're somewhere on holiday, it's very hard to get a real feel for the place, what the real problems are. But you can also have a good idea, but just by looking around, you could tell there was no crime. Young kids, teenagers weren't particularly scary. You couldn't tell which class somebody was. If you walk around city in the world or in the Western world, you could basically take a good guess at somebody's income or how well off they are. There was none of that. Everyone was well dressed but not flashy. It seemed pretty egalitarian.
There's a guy actually two blocks down the street from our place in Portland who is not somebody I've actually met yet. I'm sad to say, but I see him around, and he dresses in a suit and that he somehow keeps looking kind of pressed, but he lives in a tent two blocks away from here. And but that's very unusual. It is so much the case that you can generally tell the background of class situation of people, especially in places like the United States. From my experience, it's like obvious as soon as they open their mouth, actually, from their teeth, for one thing.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things that really struck me about going to Denmark. The first time I started spending time in Scandinavia is that's the only place that I really have spent a lot of time in that I could say you don't know the class background of most of the people that you run into. You know, you wouldn't know if they're living in a you know, what their situation is. But yeah, that's certainly not the case in most of the world, is it?
Is that a cultural thing, do you think, in Scandinavia as well, where they have, I can't remember the word they have for it, where you don't want to be the tall poppy. You don't want to, it's very frowned upon to brag about your income or be flashy.
Definitely. But also for that's definitely why the rich would not be generally driving around in sports cars or something. But even, you know, if they might have a collection of them or something, they're not going to be going around into the town with one. But the poor, well, there just isn't much poverty really. And the you know, anybody who is not doing so well, you know, it's, well, I mean, if somebody's homeless in Denmark, that means they're staying in a shelter. That doesn't mean they're actually on the streets. I mean, there's very, very few people actually on the streets, you know. Mm-hmm. So even using the term homeless. But one of the things you mentioned when you were in Belarus one time was even though the wages are relatively low, the expenses are also low. And this is something that rarely gets talked about. It seems like when they're trying to paint a picture in a country, they'll talk about like, oh, what's the income of the people? Oh, they're so low, they're so poor. But they're not really talking about the actual quality of life, which seems to be pretty high there.
That's true everywhere. It's all about your disposable income. I mean, I think the disposable income for most people in the US is a negative number. It's just credit card debt just seems to go up every month. Belarus, I think the average wage was, I don't know, maybe $300 a month. But people's rent was maybe $50 a month. And you can eat for a couple of dollars a day. So it's wages, it's a false statistic. It doesn't really mean anything. It all depends on the cost of living and how much money you have over at the end of the month. For example, here in Quito, we have very few homeless, like you see in Skid Row in Los Angeles and places like that. You'll see the random guy who genuinely has nowhere to go, but there's not huge camps. Because Rafael Correa, when he came and he introduced a minimum wage, I think it's approaching $400 a month. And obviously you see that in the US and it's... that's going to get you nothing. But you could get an apartment here in South Quito for $150 a month. You could eat for $100 a month. You're not going to be rich, but you're going to be doing okay. You're going to be surviving. You won't be worrying about next month if you get a doctor's bill or something like that. So it's all relative.
Yeah. You know, there's so many people that I run into in Europe, which of course, as you know, where I spend most of my time when I'm traveling, but people who have all kinds of opinions about what life must be like in the United States, some of whom have actually been to the US, usually not outside of New York or San Francisco, but then there's people like you who actually are very familiar with what it's like here and compared to other sort of, capitalist countries or other, whatever they want to call, whatever terms they're using these days to describe this ever-changing landscape that used to be called the West, but, you know, the countries that are the free market economies or whatever we want to call them. It's really, as somebody from here who spends a lot of time outside of the country, it's really so stark to me. And I would consider myself to be an anarchist, but it is very, the difference between American capitalism and European capitalism is just really hard to overemphasize, even in Britain compared to the United States, you know, which is probably the most backwards country in Western Europe, but in terms of their, living standards and quality of life and government competency and stuff like that. But can you talk a little about that? Like what are the contrast that you've seen and just anything that comes to mind? I don't have a particular question. I just,
I remember it makes me think of the first time I came to the US, I think it was 2008. That's where I met you actually. And before that, all my impressions of the US, they come from television, from culture, from unfortunately the TV show I hate most in the world, which is Friends. Everyone thinks that's the US. Everyone's happy, loads of consumer goods, having a good time, eating in fancy restaurants. And when I came there, I was kind of blown away I mean, even in Portland, in the center, it looks nice. You have shops, and but 10 minutes outside, it's like a crumbling civilization. There's the infrastructure's in tatters. People's houses are in tatters. There's no public transportation system. And then if you look deeper, you find out people are one paycheck away from sleeping on the streets. I mean, I've got friends that, even with health insurance, I think one of them, she had tonsillitis. She still had to pay like $2,000-$3,000. And she had health insurance. So I was trying to explain, no, you don't have health insurance because
that's how much you could pay. You could just go to any number of countries and just pay that much for the operation without health insurance.
Or even if your car breaks down and you have to pay $500, some people are screwed. They'll be recuperating that all year. So many people are living on the edge. There's so much fear that people have, and maybe that's why it's harder to organize, because they have so many problems coming at them from every direction. Or at least in Europe, and yeah, the UK has changed a lot in the last 30, 40 years. But most of Western Europe, there is a safety net. You can go to university for free. We have public health care. It's something we don't even think about. It's even now, if I'm in a country which doesn't have health insurance, I won't be worried, because in my subconscious, it's if I get sick, I go to a hospital, they treat me, and that's it. I don't even think about that. And so people in Europe don't have to worry about basic things like that.
And that's true in Ecuador too, in terms of hospital, if you need medical care. What's it like there?
They do have a free public healthcare system. It's not amazingly advanced like in Western Europe. It was introduced by Korea. It's fairly new, but you can go to and see a doctor for free. Obviously, if you want something complicated like chemotherapy, and if you have the money, you should probably go private. But yeah, you can go and see if you're genuinely sick and you need to see a doctor, you don't have to put it off. You know, you can see a doctor for free if you need to.
And that was actually true. Our friend Saed Banura, one of many people we both know from Palestine, it's really quite striking that even under the occupation, even under Israeli occupation, they still had free medical care under their, you know, in that situation somehow or other.
It amazes everybody in the world that the U.S. does not have healthcare. It blows everyone away. Mm-hmm. Truly unbelievable. I mean, Ecuador, you can understand. It's a Latin American kind of developing country. We don't have the resources, and yet still, if you need to see a doctor, you can for free. Yeah. And the U.S., which is the richest country in history, doesn't have that most basic system.
One of the more entertaining trips that you took in recent years that I'm aware of was you did what many serious football or soccer here, but football in the rest of the world fans do, and they travel to follow their favorite teams, and and some people do that in a really pretty serious way, like our my longtime touring partner Attila the Stockbroker will organize entire tours around where his local team Brighton Hove Albion is playing, and according on tours based on away games. But you did something that is for what's the word? I don't know, for political reasons, really, in addition to economic, but especially for political reasons, basically impossible for the overwhelming majority of the team's fans to do. You went and traveled around and followed around the Palestinian national football team when they were touring in Australia, right? And can you just tell us a bit of the highlights of that experience?
Yeah, that was a good trip. It was their first the first tournament that they'd ever qualified for. It's the AFC, the Asian Football Cup. It's basically like Euro 2020, where all the best teams in Europe play a tournament. There, it's the best teams in Asia, so you have to qualify for it. Palestine qualified by going through a mini tournament with some of the smaller teams. It was played in the Maldives, and they beat They were complete underdogs, but they beat Philippines in the final to go through. And I thought, and before the competition started, I thought, yeah, if they qualify, I'll go. I didn't really expect them to do it. But they did, and I thought, well, I'd kind of agreed to myself that if they qualified, I'd go. So I booked myself a ticket, and I contacted a few people. They got knocked out in the first, after the first few games. I mean, that was to be expected. The troubles that they have to go through just to train, just to leave the country. Obviously, Israel decides whether they can go and practice. The Gaza players can go to the West Bank, or if they can actually leave. So it's an incredible achievement for them just to qualify. And they played three games in Australia. You've been to Australia, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You've toured Australia.
Yeah, a few times.
Up in Newcastle, uh-huh. North Sydney. Then one in Melbourne and one in Canberra, in the capital. I got to meet all the players, and the head of the Palestinian Football Association, I can't remember his name now. Jibril Rajoub. He used to be Yasser Arafat's number two. He spent 15, 20 years in prison. Very serious looking guy. And I met him, and he was very happy that people had come from different places in the world to support the Palestinian football team. There were people there from Ireland, the UK, all over.
Right.
They lost to Japan in the first game. I think it was 4-0.
That's kind of a cruel setup there. To go. Japan has a very strong team, last I checked.
Then they lost to Iraq 2-0. And they lost to Jordan, the Dead Sea Derby. They lost 5-1, but they did the first goal in any international tournament, and the crowd went wild. It was an amazing experience.
You could celebrate the one goal at least, anyway.
That's right. At least we got one goal. Yeah, but they'll be back. They'll be back.
And you got a job in China? Is that?
That's right. I'm moving to China. Well,
theoretically, I mean, or for sure. I mean, they're opening up in China with all the testing and everything. So that'll be, if you're moving to China, that'll be one of the few places in the world that will feel kind of normal, I imagine, compared to anywhere else.
I'm moving to Shenzhen in a couple of months to start in August. Shenzhen's just over the border from Hong Kong. I have to go through this. I probably have to spend 2 weeks quarantine in Hong Kong, and then maybe another 2 weeks quarantine in Shenzhen.
Mm. Why? Because you're going to Hong Kong first, and you're not just switching flights there.
It is literally 30 minutes over the border, so yeah. The flights to Shenzhen direct cost, I don't know, $3,000-$4,000, whereas $1,000.
So then, to save money on the flight, you go to Hong Kong and then you quarantine there. Basically, you have to quarantine there. Yeah, okay. That's an interesting little logistical problem.
I mean, it might change. It might be okay in a month or two. I don't know. But, I mean, that's one of the reasons why Asian countries seem to be handling it. They have a lot less cases now. They seem to have been getting rid of the virus. The governments have set up guidelines, so they are following them. It's the same for everyone. It's not this city can follow the guidelines, but this city, it doesn't matter. People do respect it. They have a lot of experience. Even before this, when I left Hong Kong 4 years ago, they had the SARS outbreak in 2003. I wasn't there then. But for years afterwards, even until when I left, you still see 20%, 25% of people wear masks. They're very wary. If you cough on the metro, people will look at you and move away. So they've perfected social distancing and being careful. They still were disinfecting like shops, metro stations for years, even until I left. And so it's very easy for them to go back to that, to implement safety systems.
Yeah. And what are you going to be doing in Shenzhen?
Same job I'm doing now. I'm going to be a college counselor in a school in Shenzhen. Yeah.
Yeah. And you lived for quite a while in Hong Kong. And one of the this is another one of those places, in at least in terms of like the sort of the left wing corners of YouTube, and where people are having angry debates with each other. Belarus is one of those iconic things they have to argue about, the communists and the capitalists, but then Hong Kong is another one of those things where you have a very wide diversity of opinion internationally, generally 99.9% people who have never been to Hong Kong, and they're but they have very strong opinions about the protest movement there, movements there, and what they're about, and who backs them or who doesn't back them, and what they're trying to achieve. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just talk about what's been going on in Hong Kong over the past year or so. I mean, it's a huge question, really, but just in the past like year, what's happening there?
It's extremely complicated, and it changes every day. And to even focus on one thing will be ignoring 10 things that are just as important.
That's the problem generally with these interviews, though. Just FYI, just on a little aside. I mean, an hour actually is not very long, and even if we stuck to one subject, that's why books are really nice. You can really get into something in a book. But anyway, continue.
But for example, the one thing that a big issue is universal suffrage. People want to freely elect their own leader of Hong Kong, but there's like a pool, and then Beijing will vet who you can vote for, which is pretty much like the US system, where the capitalists vet who you can you only have two parties as well in the US, and they vet which one it's going to be. So there's been protests in that, but there's a lot of anger, not so much anger in Hong Kong, but there's a lot of desperation of the young people. I mean, accommodation is so expensive, and the accommodation is tiny. Jobs are very poorly paid. There's not much hope for young people. So, I mean, if you look at the protests, it is 90% university students or younger, or people in their early 20s. They just don't see much of a future for themselves. So they are protesting. I mean, there's a lot of other issues, and it's very fractured, the movements. I mean, you'll see like one of the news channels will show a couple of students holding US flags. China will say it's all funded by the US. It is extremely complicated and extremely factionalized. Mm-hmm. And it's not a problem that can be solved within Hong Kong, because Hong Kong's, right. If China can do whatever it wants. So unless there's some kind of mass movement in China that changes things, then it's going to be nearly impossible for Hong Kong people to change anything themselves.
Right. It's one of those many situations, isn't it? Like there is no local, national, or subnational, or whatever regional solution. It's the Palestine question. And it always strikes me that way. Like, and also, like, well, I mean, to take any number of other situations, that Lebanon, the civil war in Syria, these are not things that can be solved except by the great powers being involved, because they've already been involved, and they're. Yeah, that's how the situation got to be how it is, because of historical great power involvement in the world. But, Jack, in the past, in 2019, there were massive protests in so many different countries going on. It was like, it's hard to overstate how that the situation was in the fall of 2019. In Chile, in Lebanon, in Algeria, in Sudan. You just go down the list of continents and countries, and it's just, it was really quite something. And I don't know where it might have been heading or where it is heading or what's going to, how the pandemic and the response to it is going to interrupt or change all that or amplify things in different ways. But did your travels take you to any other hot spots aside from Ecuador during that time?
I don't think so. I'm in November. I was in Europe, so I didn't really see any other protests around the world in 2019. Just the ones here when we were locked down for 3 months here in Quito. But mm-hmm. I think What it showed me, I mean, the protest here started because of a fuel subsidy, something tiny. And like, I can't remember the name of your song about the Mohamed Bouazizi. No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tunisian fruit seller.
Yeah.
Basically triggered the whole Arab Spring. You had half a continent in flames because of a police bribe. And it shows you that huge events can happen from something tiny that nobody could predict. And that's usually how you have all these experts predicting changes, but they're always wrong. It's usually something nobody ever predicts. And I think this, and this is not a tiny thing, this, the coronavirus, the lockdown globally, it's quite a big thing. Mm-hmm. It's the whole world. So I'd be interested to see if there's any huge change that comes about from this, and specifically this time in the US, because the US seems to be handling it specifically badly,
mm-hmm.
With no kind of infrastructure to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to happen in a couple of months when you have 40 million unemployed people who can't pay their rent, who are going to get sick, and because they don't have a job, they don't have health insurance, and they were before living day to day and just getting by, but now they've kind of fallen off the edge of the cliff and they have nothing to lose. I mean, I don't know what the reaction is going to be if it gets that bad.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, what you say about experts and left-wing intellectuals and people making predictions and generally being wrong, I mean, that's, from my lived experience, that is so true. I've never known left-wing intellectuals to make any accurate predictions about anything, really, in terms of like things that happen. Like, I mean, of course, general predictions about, yes, there will be another mass movement, that kind of thing, okay, but in terms of anything specific, you know, it's usually it's too unpredictable. Like, who knew that it was going to be Mohamed Bouazizi and the fruits and that particular cop in that particular situation, that particular town, that was going to be the thing that was going to set something off? I mean, what is going to be the match that sets off a prairie fire? Who knows? But this is obviously one of those situations where we can say something is going to happen,
but yeah, it's inevitable.
But yeah. I mean, I know it's like, so given that your prediction is probably going to be wrong, you care to make any predictions?
Let me see. I think Trump's going to win the next election in November. That's my one prediction.
We have two sort of serial, I mean, among other things, two serial harassers of women and rapists, basically, running against each other. It's really quite, both white guys in their 70s, both hopelessly corrupted. Is quite, anyway, continue. Trump's going to win.
I'm pretty sure Trump's going to win. As for the world economy, I mean, like Naomi Klein wrote about the shock doctrine. I mean, there's people out there thinking how we can profit from this. We can do loads of stuff with this. The people, I mean, a lot of people are going to end up working from home permanently. I mean, that cannot. The thing with predictions is you always sound like a conspiracy theorist when things are going to happen. But people, there will be people who look for advantages in every situation. I mean, if they think, well, if we can get people to work from home, well, we're going to save money on office space. We won't have to rent office space. It's going to be harder for people to organize. Obviously people working in Amazon factories who are not being taken care of at all, and they're risking their lives every day so Jeff Bezos can make an extra $50 billion. So he's obviously profiting from this. But yeah, there's,
I mean, during the last Great Depression, there was a really large movement of the unemployed, and the labor movement here grew massively. But of course, there was also a government that came to power that was sympathetic to the labor movement in 1932. But do you think, I mean, the thing is, of course, there's also a large neo-fascist movement here in the United States, as you know. And
yeah.
This is the thing that I guess, you know, people endlessly wonder about at these sorts of precipice moments, you know, where things tend to go towards extremes, one extreme or another, where, you know, fascism or actual solidarity. But mm-hmm. I mean, with Trump talking so much about a war with China, and I know you spend a lot of time over in that part of the world, is that something that is on the radar? Like, is that something that's a real fear for people?
I don't think so. I don't think people are afraid of that. And I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, China needs the US markets. and the US needs the cheap manufacturing. So I don't think, I mean, they're friends, they need to stay friends. I mean, there's a lot of bluster, they'll talk a lot, and they're not going to change anything. I know most of my predictions have been negative.
Yeah, and I think people said that kind of thing about Germany before they invaded England, too.
I mean, in the US, I can see, I don't know if it's going to be more of a political movement, more of an anarchist, but maybe not anarchist, an anarchy situation where there are so many people, there's nothing for them to do. There's no safety net for them. And they're just going to say, okay, well, I can't pay rent. We're not going to pay rent. And the knock-on effects in every area of the economy, I can see it. Yeah, I can see it heading towards a Great Depression that could last 10 years.
And then I wonder what happens with all the police coming to evict all the people that can't pay the rent, and when their relatives are also unable to pay the rent and also getting evicted. I wonder how that's going to play out. You know, there's been so many situations historically where the authorities don't feel like they can trust their own police forces, but that's often not a problem because police often tend to be fascists in many, many different societies. It's a tendency. Those are the kind of people who are often attracted to the job in many different societies. I don't know if that's a universal thing, but it's certainly true here and certainly true in Greece where they've actually studied that, you know, it's a very interesting statistic in Greece with like only 7% of the society votes for the fascist party, but 50% of the police.
That's it. Yeah. Golden. Is it Golden Dawn?
Golden Dawn. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a scary name.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I read the other day, I think they're talking about laying off police officers in some cities or states in the US because they don't have the money, which would be surprising because usually the police, especially whenever there's a problem, the governments take care of the police because they're going to need them to protect them when it all falls apart.
Yeah, just getting rid of the police would be a really good way to avoid the problem of having to deal with mass evictions. Because if the police can't evict people because there aren't any, then that's that seems unlikely. But
So yeah, my predictions are negative. I'm not seeing anything positive at the moment, unless it's like when we have a complete collapse and we do have to change the way we live.
Although the situation is making some countries look much better, because who are dealing with it competently, and I think worth noting that they're not all in East Asia either. Some of them are other places like Cuba, which has, from what I've heard, done a great job of all kinds of tracing and testing, as well as producing some of the only medication with a Chinese company that is actually apparently effective potentially in AIDS, right? Their AIDS medicines in Cuba that they developed, which may be related to this virus.
I think with Cuba, it's like they've had a history of 60 years now of just being on a constant war footing against problems, the embargo, invasion, terrorist acts. That every new problem, it's like, okay, how are we going to solve this one? It's like, I remember, I think it was Hurricane Katrina. Was it 2006?
2005. And they offered to send help to New Orleans and it was turned down.
But it hit Cuba before, the week before, or it might have been another one around the same time.
Yeah.
But I remember like the government mobilized, I think Fidel Castro was there with his combat fatigues on again, like he was fighting a war again. And I think they had there was one person died.
Yeah. Was,
we can rebuild everything. We can't rebuild your lives. And people trusted the government.
Mm-hmm.
What they were told, they evacuated. So every time there is a crisis in Cuba, it's like, okay, we're gonna beat this one as well. It's they have a lot of experience of this kind of hardship. So yeah, they seem to handle it very well, much better than in the US.
One of the I've been asking you before about Belarus, but one of the when I see your Instagram feed, which I follow very jealously, because I like to travel and you do even more traveling than I do, you've spent a lot of time in the former Soviet countries, and and every time I see pictures that you're posting, I see why, because there's so much history and so much beauty. But I wonder if what is it about the former Soviet countries that keeps you coming back constantly over the course of many years?
Yeah, I mean, I do. There's something about it. I mean, it's like it's an ancient civilization. It's not really ancient, but it was a completely different civilization that existed only 30 years ago, and you can still see the relics of it. And it's just, to me, it's just fascinating. And it's interesting because you can still talk to people who lived who grew up in that civilization, which was completely different. Now everything is very homogenous and generic. Going to one city, somebody's life in Warsaw or Kiev is very similar to someone growing up in Paris. Then it was completely different, and it's fascinating to hear the stories. And it was, to me, good or bad, leaving aside good or bad or advantages, disadvantages, it was a society with a goal. At least it had a goal. I don't know if you've seen the HBO series Chernobyl.
No, not yet. I heard about it, though. It's been talked about a lot.
Yeah. And there's like a propaganda poster in it. And one of the episodes is actually called The Happiness of All Mankind, which sounds very cheesy, very cliched propaganda. But it was there was a goal that, okay, we'll give everyone housing. We'll make sure everyone has healthcare. Everyone can have an education if they want it. Women will have access to healthcare, to reproductive rights. It had a genuinely noble goal. Whether it achieved it in some places or not, or how they achieved it, is another discussion. But it did have a goal. In society today, in the West, what's the goal?
Yeah, right. Who knows?
Yeah, just survive, get by, buy stuff.
Or maybe they'd say that it would be wrong to have a goal, because that would mean that there's something called society, and really we're just a collection of individuals. So why should we have a goal other than to be happy as individuals, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Perhaps individual happiness is the goal in the West. I don't know.
And then another reason I like going is for the memorials, for statues, the war monuments. Mm-hmm. It's kind of been forgotten about the role that the Soviet Union played in World War II and liberating Europe. If it wasn't for them,
we
might not be here, or Europe would have gone under, would have succumbed to fascism. And that seems to be forgotten about. So I like going there for the history as well.
You know, I haven't traveled much in Eastern Europe, but when I did travel quite a bit around Eastern Germany when not that long after, even when there were still more relics of the past around. And one of the things that struck me about the public art was how good it was. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of it was really, really beautiful stuff. Not at all like the way it gets painted in the West as like yet another statue of Lenin or whatever. I mean, of course, yes, lots of statues of Lenin, but also all kinds of other great public art all over the place. Yeah.
Definitely the more mosaics. I'm fascinated by kind of socialist realism design, the architecture, because it basically they had a workforce and they wanted to keep everyone employed, and they wanted to try new things. So the architecture is very different. All the bus stops even were decorated with amazing mosaics because it didn't really cost anything. Mm. Needed to keep people employed. So there was never anyone looking at going, this is too expensive.
When you're going to employ everybody like that and you're going to make sure everybody's employed, all the calculations change, don't they? Like one of the things that struck me, and I think would strike any American, especially listening to this program, was I heard an interview with, I don't remember who it was, some politicians in Stockholm, Sweden, and they were talking about how it made sense to heat the sidewalks. And the reason it made sense to heat the sidewalks was because it prevented people from falling and breaking their bones. And therefore, it saved money on hospital expenses. So when the government is paying for everything like that, and it's an actual functioning society, then you can make a calculation like that. And then it makes sense to heat the sidewalks.
Yeah. I mean, there's a huge problem in the one major failing of, and it's not, I don't think it's designed, it's just a byproduct of so-called Western democracies with the elections. Nobody can plan more than 4 or 5 years ahead. Every guy just wants to get elected. Mm-hmm. So if they say this is going to be a huge advantage in 10 years, he doesn't care. Why would he care? He wants immediate results now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. The 5-year plan is less relevant with the 2-year election cycle.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine who lived for a time, I think it was in Moscow, from Texas, and he said the apartment he was living in was a perfectly nice apartment with electricity, running water, and everything. And and everybody he knew lived in other perfectly nice apartments like that, and they paid almost no rent. It was like 3% of your income you had to pay for rent was the charge, right? So but then he was wondering just like, what happens if you don't pay the rent? Like, I mean, you know, just, I know it's not much, but what happens? And so he was asking people in the local party branch, like, you know, how does that work? And they said, well, there's an old lady basically who's going to come around and knock on your door and ask you to pay the rent. And then, well, what happens if you say no at that point? Well, she'll come back. And then what? Then what? Well, nothing. That's about it. They'll talk about you in a meeting, and somebody might say something bad about you, and then that's it, because you can't be evicted, you know.
No, that's a great system. I mean, I'm guessing in the US that the number of homeless is less than the number of vacant properties.
Way, way, way less. And that's talked about in you know, circles, advocacy circles all the time. The number of vacant apartments in any given city is always way more than the number of homeless people. And of course, the number of vacant hotel rooms during the pandemic, they're almost all vacant.
That in Nevada, they were making people sleep in parking lots when they had 1 million hotel rooms vacant.
That's what they're doing right now all over the country. In Santa Cruz, California, in one of the richest towns in the world, you know, they're putting the homeless in on a parking lot in metal pens with a hygiene station, so-called.
You know. Yeah, it's barbaric.
Yeah.
It also exposes the myth that everyone, when people argue about capitalism, they say capitalism is efficient. It's the most efficient system. It's not efficient to have people unemployed or 2 million people sleeping on the streets. It's not an efficient system. They're not making the most of these people.
No. And it's not efficient for the people who want to be, you know, for the rich either, right? I mean, and when you think of the efficiency of it in terms of like the public health disaster for everybody else and the lower lifespan, even for the rich who live in a society where there's a public health disaster in every city all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this might show that up because I know more poor people are getting infected at the moment because of the jobs they have to do, and it's very hard to social distance if you're living in a small apartment with your entire family or other people. But it will affect, be rich people will see this is going to affect me as well. This does threaten me as well.
When are you going to move to China? Do you know? Is that kind of on hold now, or is that planning in the planning phase?
I'm hoping to fly there in July. Mm-hmm. I had my visa appointment, and then they closed the embassy the same day. So I'm going to have to do it electronically. But July, I should be in China to start work in beginning of August.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm still quarantined here, then hope to interview you from China sometime in August. See what's going on there.
Hope when I can travel, I can travel to the US to drive up to see you again.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, yeah.
If you're open, if your country is still there, if your country still exists next year,
if the country hasn't burned down by next year, and if the borders aren't, if we're not being, if they haven't canceled all the flights from all the other countries, and they don't want Americans coming over and infecting them, yeah. Jack, thanks so much for joining me for my live stream program.
Gracias, David.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. See you again.
Okay, see you later.
Take care.
You too.
And that was Jack Muir in Quito, Ecuador. And I hope you've enjoyed our little discussion. And I'll be back tomorrow talking with my friend Chrissy Kirchhofer from Missouri. who has had a fascinating life of activism and organizing and all sorts of things. And you can find this archived on my YouTube channel under the Discussions with David playlist. And you can also look it up as in podcast form shortly if you go to look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. You can also find more broadcasts and other songs and playlists and things related to the virus at davidrovics.com/quarantine. And if you want to support my broadcasting efforts, then feel free to go to davidrovics.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovics. And this has been another episode of Discussions with David. Thank you very much for joining us. See you again. Bye-bye. Don't pay the rent.